I'm with David Rome. Hi, David.
Hello.
So we're going to have a conversation about what focusing is for you. Maybe the first question be, how did you come into focusing?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I got into Buddhism and meditation in my mid-20s, much, much earlier than I knew anything about focusing. So I had done a lot of Buddhist study and practice. Then about, I guess, 12 years ago, I was in a used bookstore in Putney, Vermont. This little paperback called Focusing by Eugene Gendlin kind of just dropped into my hand, which is an experience I've had maybe three or four times in my life, that a book that's going to set me on a new course appears seemingly just by accident. For me, it was quite simply about getting more in touch with my feelings. Somebody has written an essay about close process and distant process. So I'm a distant process person. I've always had limited access to my emotions. The Buddhist meditation, I think it helped, but it didn't make that much difference. So then I started going to workshops levels, and developed a focusing partnership with Carolyn Worthing, who was very generous in taking me on when I was a beginner, and we're still at it 10 or 11 years later. I went to several of the Thinking at the Edge programs, so I met Dean and actually got to know him quite well, which I'm extremely appreciative about, as well as getting to know Mary. Well, I guess that covers how I came to focusing.
Yeah. So there's that sense of something appearing, you know, at a moment where it was needed of you having certainly opened up to the need for more of close process as opposed to distant process, more connection to feelings.
Yes. Yes, I mean, I still can't claim that I have close process at all, really, but I do have more access to my feelings. Occasionally I will go inside and just, do some clearing of space and then stay with a felt sense. But more frequently what works for me is to, work on an issue. And I do almost all my focusing I do, with a partner. So I'm sharing and I'm getting reflection. We take notes for each other sometimes and exchange them. So I find that by spending some time with the issue and telling a bit of the story about the issue, while keeping a one eye on the feelings realm, that's what that works well for me.
Right. So that's something that you sometimes do focusing for clearing a space, but more often than not, it's about an issue. And the experience of it is really linked to having a partner. So there is a sense of keeping a part of your attention on the felt sense, but also having the experience of a partner.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so that... you know, related to what you were saying about emotion and you know, does this have something, is that the difference that you experience between that and meditation?
Yes. They, broadly speaking, they're in the same experiential territory, I would say. But they really move in different directions, at least for me. Meditation, so I practice in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and my basic training in sitting meditation was just a very simple mindfulness awareness practice, using the breath as an object of attention, and when thoughts or feelings, sensations arise, noticing those, actually a little bit more than noticing. My teacher, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, talked about the process as touch and go. And I think that the touch, by saying touch, he was trying to point us toward a felt sense. That he didn't want, it wasn't just like a reflex that as soon as you realize I'm thinking, oh, go back to the breath. But there is a moment of recognition there. Now you don't go into it or you don't sit with it in the way that you would in focusing. But I think up to that point there is a lot of similarity, and clearly in focusing, there is mindfulness and awareness happening and being cultivated. So they're both listening practices, receiving practices. What the poet John Keats called negative capability, which is a wonderful phrase. And for him it was a very positive thing. But he called it negative capability.
Yeah. So something very deep about the practice you call deep listening.
Right, yes. And so, yeah, let me say a little bit about that. You know, when I first got into focusing, I, in a way, it was like when I first got into Buddhism, and you know, this was back in the early 70s, and it was very fringy, kind of out there, and so in terms of my family and friends, I was pretty shy about talking about it. So as I got into focusing, I kind of felt that way toward my Buddhist sangha, as if you know, I was doing something slightly heretical here. But that didn't last that long, and you know, within a couple of years I had kind of found my confidence in the practice. I understood how much how complementary focusing is to meditation, and how the meditation, the mindfulness awareness, is a natural sound starting place for moving into focusing. And I also recognize that for a variety of reasons, people who were practicing in the Buddhist tradition, kind of traditional Buddhist meditation, were not contacting the felt sense. And they were really missing a big area there. And also many of them were not, you know, like myself, were not fully in touch with their emotions and had no way of bringing the meditation into their lives in terms of actually working with issues, problems, challenges, you know, relationships. And the usual advice was just sit more. You know, you're having a feud with your partner. Well, just sit more.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not necessarily bad advice, but it's not the whole story. And so I was motivated to bring focusing back to my home sangha. And the way that that came to me to do that was by emphasizing listening.
Uh-huh.
You know, because that's also something that, I mean, it's so ubiquitous in our culture in general that people don't listen well, but it was also true within many spiritual communities that people really don't listen very well to each other. And so I took the theme of listening and then added deep. Since I started, I have discovered many other people use that term, deep listening, including Thich Nhat Hanh, the wonderful
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese Buddhist teacher. But I think I thought it was original with me at the time. Nobody has a copyright on it. But I developed a particular approach that was largely introducing people to focusing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So introducing people to focusing who already had a meditation practice or...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was doing, at the beginning, all of my teaching was done at Shambhala meditation centers.
Mm-hmm.
I would be invited and I would travel and teach usually for a weekend, occasionally for longer. And at one of my programs, one of the participants was a wonderful woman named Hope Martin, who is now also part of the focusing community. Hope is a teacher, really a master teacher of the Alexander technique. And I started taking lessons with her, my wife and I did, and we would get into conversation and she would talk about Mr. Alexander's concepts and some of his weird language, and I would say, oh, well, that's just like, you know, meditation or just like Buddhism. So we really enjoyed exploring it together, and then we said, hey, let's teach together.
Uh-huh.
And so for the past, I guess, about 8 years, most, not all, but most of my deep listening has been done together with Hope. And it's just so wonderful having a partner. And what she brings, this very subtle body awareness work, is not something that I could do.
Mm-hmm. So it's been an expansion in a way from finding mindfulness in sitting meditation to experiencing that something mindfulness resonance in focusing in Alexander technique, but just that I have that sense of expansion as you talk.
Definitely it is. Now the mindfulness awareness practice has its own path which goes in a different direction and it deepens and goes more toward non-thought, emptiness, non-attachment, non-ego, and so forth. And all of those, I think, are things that people touch on in focusing, but don't necessarily stay with in the way that you would in Buddhist practice.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, they're wonderfully complementary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, complimentary and, you know, opening up new areas.
Yes. You know, Buddhism starts with non-self, non-ego. And when that is introduced in a Western context, things get a little complicated. Because in our culture, virtually everybody, if not everybody, has this inner critic. What Ching Jendam calls the critic. And so non-self or non-ego, non-attachment often gets misinterpreted to mean rejecting what's most personal in our experience. And rejecting the whole sense of personhood, of unique individual personality. And this is something that that Gene has always pointed out. I mean, he's had a fair amount of contact with Buddhists and other Eastern spiritual practices. I know now that that is not the intention of the Buddhist teaching. But I think since it developed in one cultural context and then was introduced in another, that has been a kind of a stumbling block or a sticking point. And so focusing is very helpful there.
Right, right. So it's not a question of losing yourself in some way, or it is, but in a different way than people understand it.
Right. The issue around attachment to one's experience as a way of bolstering the sense of identity or some kind of solidity in one's life. That's a very real and profound issue, and that Buddhism knows all about that and has many, many ways of working step by step around that issue. I'll leave it at that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but in focusing, in some ways, you know, we stay with, you know, we more than touch and go with a felt sense. We stay with it.
Right, exactly. We stay with it and we let it come into focus, which is where Gene came up with the name focusing, which is really, as he himself says, not a very good name for what we do. We stay with the felt sense in a friendly, interested way and let it become more clear.
And in that sense, could we say that we're not attached to ordinary experience because we're willing to let go of just the immediate interpretation, the immediate way of thinking, but kind of stay in that murky zone?
Well, definitely. You know, definitely that quality of freshness and opening intuition in focusing is very much in the direction of non-attachment, non-clinging, non-solidification. The only thing I would say there is that sometimes with focusers, I see a tendency to, how can I say this, to be a little too loyal to one's own issues and problems and keeping coming back to oneself. And there are times when a different kind of letting go, such as one learns in meditation, I think may take you further, further along than just returning again and again.
Mm-hmm. So an attachment to the story.
Yeah, an attachment to the story, but it is about myself. It's almost like a fascination with myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and it's not that we aren't, each of us, very fascinating. We are. But I think there can be a danger there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, so I kind of the way the word fascination may be the part of fascination, so that you latch onto this, you're unable to focus on something else. It just it's just too strong a distraction to be able to see something else. So we're talking about attachment, and in a paradoxical way. So when you're talking from the Buddhist language, you talk about non-attachment, but you're also very interested in attachment in a sense of the psychological theories about attunement and attachment.
Yes. Okay, that's a different use of attachment.
Very, very different. So maybe it feels like a total...
So just to be clear about that, this is what's called attachment theory in Western psychology, and it is about the tremendous importance of the attunement between the primary caregiver, usually the mother, and the infant, and young child. And how much difference that makes as to whether that child has a healthy ego in the Western good sense,
mm-hmm.
As they mature or not.
Buddhists
have also observed you have to have a healthy ego before you work on getting rid of it. attachment, attunement, begins in that attachment relationship of the infant and the mother, and then develops from there. I forgot what I was going to say. That's all right. Let's go on.
Yeah. So.
I was going to say that quality of attunement to other, which is really how you learn about the difference between self and other to begin with, then is also what is brought to and cultivated in both mindfulness and focusing. It's an attuning to oneself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So in a way, instead of just talking about the differences, another way to approach it is to see that the underlying strength of both practices is about strengthening that attunement.
Yes, it is... you know, it's still about being able to distinguish self and other, even when it's just internal. So there's the subjective side, or the sometimes called witness consciousness, the observer, and then there's what is noticed.
Mm-hmm.
The object of attention. And what you find in both mindfulness and focusing is there's an awful lot of stuff running around in there that has never gotten discriminated, never gotten distinguished. So that the subjective and the objective parts are all kind of mushed together. And so what you're doing and clearing the space and focusing is a wonderful example of it, is you're noticing something and then setting it out in front of you, so that it, you can look at it and relate to it as a kind of object.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, there is a certain way of everything being confused together that is not, you know, the ultimate experience of oneness, but is actually confusion. And having the ability to sort out subject-object is something that is a very useful tool.
Yes, I mean, I really see it as a developmental process. It's not that it's a bad thing to begin with. It's part of what everyone goes through in their growth process. Robert Keegan at Harvard has written wonderful stuff about this process of moving from what he calls one order of consciousness to the higher order of consciousness. And he's got, I think, five, and the last couple are adult levels of development. And in each case, in making that transition, you are able to see the place that you were coming from before that you couldn't see. So it's kind of like the eye can't see itself until there's a mirror, and then suddenly you see, oh, that's what I look like, and those are my eyes. And it's a similar process and it's a real transformative process, because you in a sense become a different person, or the way you understand the world and make sense of things changes. Keegan's point is that our culture is so complex that it can't really be coped with successfully without having a high order of consciousness. So it's actually the culture itself, with all its demands, is also pushing one in that direction. So that's the thing on a large scale that really excites me about focusing, especially about focusing, is that I think it offers this wonderful way of starting to be able to step out of yourself and look back and see how you were.
Mm-hmm.
And by seeing how you were, you are already, who you are is already growing, even though you can't see who you are now yet. You won't see that until later on.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a stepwise process and a transformative process and a living growth process. So it's exciting, and I think that more and more people are becoming ready for that kind of step, and so they need the tools.
Yeah. So that what happens in focusing is we're able to step back and see ourselves how we were. And in addition to seeing how we were, it also gives us a sense of being in a process where at some point we might be able to actually look back and see how we are now.
Right. You know, we'll always be looking that is further along than the one we can see.
Yeah.
It's an unfolding like that in stages.
Yeah, so that big sense of unfolding and a sense of how necessary it is, or how useful or how meaningful it is in this time and age.
Right, and just to say a little bit more about Keegan's work, he has a level, I think it's his level 4, that he calls modernity. And he feels that most people in our culture do manage to reach that level, although some of them don't, or some of them are kind of caught in between. But modernity is about having a rational framework, and it's connected with things like ideology, a way of contextualizing yourself and your experience. Then the next level is postmodern, Keegan calls it cross-systemic. It's where you go beyond identifying with any ideology, but you can find value in many different ideologies.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Gene Gendlin's work, right away you see that that's the approach that he takes to psychology. He says, you know, you can work in a Freudian model, in a Jungian model, in a Rogerian model, and get value out of all of those.
Mm-hmm.
There's not one model that is right or covers the whole territory. And also, Gene's philosophy of the implicit is a positive way of talking about the postmodern view.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so important. Keegan makes this point also, that a lot of postmodernism has been a rejection of what came before, deconstruction and cultural relativism and so forth. But now we're beginning to have people like Gene, who are at the forefront of cultural development, who are able to show us the way in positive terms. So the philosophy of the implicit, which we don't have time to go into here,
mm-hmm.
To my mind, it's the most advanced and the most sophisticated positive postmodern understanding of life.
Mm. Yeah. So as you talk about this, I also get a sense that part of the quest is, in a way, a personal quest, in a good way, of the sense of person, but also a quest for seeing how we fit into the world, into the universe.
Yes, very much so, and that also has to do with aging. I'll be 64 in June, I'm much more motivated by what small contribution I may be able to make than what more I can get for myself. And that also comes from the Buddhist side and the vow to save all sentient beings, which is very ambitious, but that's why I'm very interested in where the culture is at, where I see people stuck and suffering, and how to, again, provide some context, provide some tools and guidance that would allow people to get beyond those blocks and enter this new territory,
mm-hmm.
which is not paradise, but it's alive.
Right.
Real.
Right. So this sounds like it could be a good place to conclude this conversation, unless you feel like there's something you would want to add.
No, I agree. I agree. Thank you.
This is part of the Focusing Conversations series of the Focusing Institute, hosted by Serge Prangle. All contents are protected by copyright. You can find other such conversations on our website at focusing.org/conversations.